This flash briefing was made possible by a sponsorship from AveXis, a clinical stage gene therapy company. The following content was not developed by AveXis.
Today is Monday, March the 18th, 2019. I'm Michael Morale, Director of Multichannel Content for SMA News Today.
About 100 scientists, researchers, pharmaceutical executives, and others converged on Austria's capital this month. It was for the second International Congress on Advanced Treatments in Rare Diseases. The meeting took place at the Hilton Amstead Park in Vienna. It featured 27 speakers on a variety of disorders, ranging from SMA to Parkinson's disease. Nearly a third of the speakers were from Israel, including conference chair Ari Zimran, MD. He is director of the Gaucher Clinic at Jerusalem's Shaar Zedek Medical Center. Gaucher is an amazing model for rare diseases because even though in Israel, where diseases occur in about 1 in 850 Ashkenazi Jews, there is no awareness. Even if doctors have heard about it, they are unlikely to consider it because in medicine there, that's the way they've been educated. Zimran's clinic was founded in 1990 and has grown to become the world's largest specialized facility for treating Gaucher disease. He said that there are many topics that will be covered in Vienna, such as the design of clinical trials, funding for research, digital health, ethical aspects of rare diseases, and the role of biobanking and big data in healthcare. Zimran spoke to BioNews Services and said, "Doctors often don't think about rare diseases. Only 5% of the 7,000 known rare diseases have effective treatments. But the tragedy of delayed diagnosis is not only for those 5% of cases, but also for the 95% of rare diseases where treatment is not available. And a delayed diagnosis can cause the development of irreversible complications and can impact the patient's quality of life. Since the diseases are often genetic, by the time you diagnose the patient, very often another affected sibling is born. If you did the diagnosis on time, you could have prevented the birth of another patient with the same disease. One such disease, SMA, was the focus of a talk by German neurologist Arndt Rolfs. He is an MD and founder and CEO of Centogene. His presentation was called Spinal Muscular Atrophy, One Rare Disease with Different Innovative Treatments. It touched on clinical and genetic aspects of SMA, as well as Spinraza as a treatment. Thomas Stalnig, MD, is a specialist in internal medicine and spoke on rare metabolic diseases. Pediatric endocrinologist Michael P. Wagenrock, MD, shared his views on challenges of drug development from the corporate perspective. Varda Shalev, MD, is the director of Israeli health network Maccabitech. They talked about biobanking and big data for rare diseases. Germany's Michael Beck, MD, analyzed study designs for rare diseases. He said that standard placebo-controlled double-blind clinical trials is often inappropriate. Uma Ramaswamy, MD, who is a consultant with the Lysosomal Disorders Unit at London's Royal Free Hospital, talked about helping patients transfer from pediatric hospitals to the adult clinics. Madeline Collin is a 24-year-old British woman with Gaucher disease. She discussed mental health and rare diseases, and what it's like living with such uncertainty. Early on, her parents were told she would not live to see adulthood. This, of course, was not true, nor was it an isolated incident. Despite the advances in awareness and diagnostic technology, some parents, patients, and their families are still given the wrong diagnosis, or they face a delay in diagnosis. This is perhaps why mental health is such a serious issue for patients with rare diseases. Beyond that, there were two presentations on gene therapy that were given, one by Gabriel Cohn, MD, and the other by Olga Uspenskaya-Kadaz, MD and PhD. The two-day event wrapped up with a special lecture by Avraham Steinberg. He discussed the ethical aspects of rare disease, such as distributive justice and the value of life. To conclude, this was the second international congress of its type. The first was called Rare 2018 and took place last year in London. In addition, the American Conference on Advanced Treatments in Rare Disease is planned for June 13th and 14th in East Brunswick, New Jersey. The following week, Centogene is sponsoring a conference. It's from June 20th to 22nd, and it's called Recent Advances in Rare Diseases, and will be held in Bogota, Colombia.
Coming up next, I'll share one of my perspectives with you.
Are you interested in understanding gene therapy? ExploreGeneTherapy.com has helpful information about gene therapy, including its history and how it is being investigated for the treatment of genetic diseases. Visit www.exploreGeneTherapy.com.
On Monday, March 11th, 2019, I checked myself into the William P. Clements Jr. University Hospital at UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, Texas. I was about to start my second year of maintenance dose injections of Spinraza. While there's still quite a bit of excitement as the date gets closer, to me, it's just another ordinary day in my life. I woke up around 6 a.m., which is my usual time to get up in the morning. My procedure wasn't scheduled until 1 p.m., but they always ask me to arrive at the hospital around 11:30 in the morning so they can do all of the prep work necessary before the procedure itself. This prep work includes getting me out of my wheelchair and putting me in bed, taking a blood and urine sample, and finishing all of the necessary paperwork that goes along with any surgical visit. I love some of the questions that the nurses ask me, like, have I been in contact with anyone with Ebola over the last couple of weeks? I've always wanted to say that I just had lunch with a friend of mine who has a raging case of Ebola, but you know, sometimes these nurses don't really have much of a sense of humor. It's kind of like going to the airport and meeting your friend Jack. When you see him walking down the hall, the last thing you want to say is, "Hi, Jack." Yeah, those TSA people have no sense of humor. Okay, getting back to my story. I usually try to keep my schedule as normal as possible with regards to the time that I wake up. This gives me plenty of time to gather my thoughts and to make sure that I have everything ready before I leave for the hospital. Not knowing if there was going to be any accidents on the freeway or traffic, I usually leave around 10:30 in the morning. For some reason, it seemed as if we were the only car on the freeway, and we actually got to the hospital at 10:45 in the morning. I went ahead and checked in like I usually do, thinking that they would just tell me to go back in the waiting area and that they would come and get me. To my surprise, right after I checked in, the nurse came and escorted me to my room. By the time they finished getting my blood and urine samples, and after finishing all of the paperwork, it was 11:30. This gave me nearly an hour to lay in bed and watch television and maybe shut my eyes for a quick cat nap. At 12:15, the student doctor came in and introduced himself to me. UT Southwestern Medical Center is a teaching hospital, so typically the student doctors are the ones who perform the procedures and the attending physician is there to supervise and make sure that everything is done correctly. Dr. Bell, after he introduced himself to me, told me that he would be assisting Dr. Scott during the procedure. The doctor that had done my previous maintenance dose injections was Dr. Steele, but he would be out for the day. Dr. Scott had actually done one of my maintenance dose injections earlier last year, so I knew who he was and I felt comfortable with him doing the procedure. Dr. Bell told me that Dr. Scott had decided that they were not going to retrieve the cerebral spinal fluid like they had usually done in previous procedures. Earlier, I had told them that after a few of my procedures, I had suffered from migraine headaches. Dr. Scott said that by not retrieving the cerebral spinal fluid, this would possibly help eliminate the migraine headaches. Dr. Bell told me that Dr. Scott would discuss this with me further before the procedure began. At 12:30, one of the surgical aides came into my room to get me. She showed me the bottle of Spinraza that was in her pocket and told me that she was guarding it with her life. As she rolled me out of my room and toward the fluoroscopy suite, she started discussing how they were going to transfer me from my bed to the fluoroscopy table. She was the same surgical aide that had transferred me a few other times, so I knew that she knew what to do, but we just went over everything just to make sure. As she rolled me into the fluoroscopy suite, there were a few other surgical aides in the room waiting for us. They pulled my bed to the side of the fluoroscopy table, and with one surgical aide on my left and another one on my right and another surgical aide controlling my legs, they slid me onto the fluoroscopy table without a problem. After twisting my body like a pretzel and getting me into the proper position, Dr. Scott and Dr. Bell came into the room. Dr. Scott made his way over to me and knelt down and started explaining why he decided not to retrieve any cerebral spinal fluid. He said that any time that they remove CSF, this changes the pressure in your back, and this change in pressure could have been the reason why I was getting migraine headaches. Dr. Scott said that they would try it this way to see if it would help. Protocol for this procedure states that 5 cc's of CSF must be withdrawn, but this protocol was written for small children and infants. There wasn't really a requirement to remove 5 cc's of CSF from adults because any additional fluid could be absorbed by the body. A few of my subscribers to my personal YouTube channel had told me that their doctors no longer retrieve CSF from them before beginning their procedures, so I had an idea as to the reason why, but hearing it from my doctor reassured me that he was looking after my best interest. After taking a few images with the fluoroscopy machine and making sure that they had my back marked in the proper location, Dr. Bell gave me a small dose of lidocaine to numb my back. After about a minute, and with the guidance and instruction from Dr. Scott, Dr. Bell inserted the needle and found his way into my central nervous system in a very short amount of time. Earlier, I had told Dr. Scott that I was a visual person and would like them to tell me exactly what they were doing. Dr. Scott gave me a play-by-play like a television announcer, so I knew exactly what was happening. After entering the central nervous system and making sure that the CSF was clear, they loaded the syringe with 5 cc's of Spinraza and began injecting it directly into the central nervous system. This process usually takes about 2 minutes, and before long, they removed the needle and put a band-aid over the puncture site. After rolling me back on my side and getting me back into my bed, the surgical aide took me back to my room. I had to lay flat on my back for 1 hour, and during this time, nurses came in 2 times to roll me over to check the puncture site to make sure that there was no leakage. After an hour, the nurses helped me transfer from the bed back to my wheelchair, and I was allowed to go home. Even though Dr. Bell and Dr. Scott didn't remove any cerebral spinal fluid, I still went by Starbucks and got me a large cup of coffee. By drinking a cup of coffee, the caffeine will dilate the blood vessels in your head, and it'll help you to keep from getting a headache. Trust me, I wasn't going to take any chances. After getting back to my house, I ate a small amount of food and decided that I would spend the rest of the day in bed watching movies. The next day, it was business as usual. Me personally, I think those of us that are going through our Spinraza injections should be allowed to stay in bed for at least 1 week after each procedure. Now comes the hard part, finding a doctor that would agree with me. The information in our flash briefings and podcast are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to SMA News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. All of our podcast and flash briefings can be found on our website at www.smanewstoday.com. You can also find our podcast and flash briefings on SoundCloud, Spotify, and iTunes. And be sure to follow us on our Instagram and Facebook page as well. For SMA News Today, I'm Michael Morale, Multichannel Content Director.